Come back to order, please, and take number 319.
Add code removing barriers to employment to establish procedures for the use of criminal history information by employers within the city.
Thank you very much. So we had an excellent hearing 2 weeks ago in which people that had been thinking about this issue and advocating for us to be a leader on this issue came and spoke to us, and also we heard, I thought, some pretty moving testimony from individuals who have been struggling to find their way back into the economy because they bear the stigma of having served time in the correctional system and paid their debt to society. So I hope that all of us felt that we should move forward on policy on this subject, and that's why we're here today, because I think it's appropriate and fits our values in Portland to broaden the workforce by giving people access to jobs who might not otherwise have that chance. We've had a lot of conversations in the community. We know there's broad support for the concept and some concerns about the particulars. We've tried to take that into account in the draft ordinance that Judy Prosper is going to walk through for us today. Without much further ado than that, I want to call Judy up. She's going to be with us for the first part of this hearing, but not the last, depending on how long it goes, because she's leaving town this evening for a trip. So, Judy, please come up and walk us through the ordinance in front of us and tell us.
I've also asked if Tracy Reed would.
And Tracy, of course, please.
Some of the questions I have.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. So, good afternoon once again, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. I'm back today to present some actual proposed code that which was filed last week with the auditor's office. That we discussed here on March 11th. The proposed code would be added to Chapter 23 of the Portland City Code, creating a new Section 2310. The ordinance accompanying the agenda item highlights the policy justifications for this proposed change to the city code. I have also provided you, I hope you've received it, with the National Employment Law Project highlights, which with anecdotal experience from around the country in jurisdictions who have adopted similar policies. I'm going to now go ahead and turn to the actual proposed code language. As you mentioned, discussions continued on the best way forward since my last appearance before you. In the draft code language, there are two major changes to the structure of the policy that was outlined 2 weeks ago. The first is that an exception would be included to account for a situation where a candidate voluntarily discloses their criminal history to an employer prior to the conditional offer stage. That can be found in the proposed section 23-10.040A. And that states if a person voluntarily discloses during an interview that he or she has a criminal history, an employer may engage in a discussion concerning the information that is voluntarily disclosed, but must still conduct an individualized assessment utilizing the factors set forth in the earlier subsection to determine whether or not the person's criminal history has a direct relationship to the person's ability to perform the duties or responsibilities of the employment sought. In such a situation, the employer could engage in discussion concerning information that has been voluntarily disclosed, but would still be required to conduct the individualized EEOC 2012 guidance factors, them being the nature and gravity of the offense, the time that has elapsed since the offense took place, and the nature of the employment sought. The second major change from what was proposed 2 weeks ago is that the private right of action against an employer has been removed. This change clarifies that the objective of the ordinance is to set out a required process for employers rather than a scheme that would substitute the determination of a trier of fact for that of an employer who conducted a good faith individualized assessment of a person's criminal history vis-a-vis the position sought. If you look at paragraph 8 of the ordinance, this objective is pretty clear. It states, an employer who makes an individualized assessment of a person's criminal history and determines in good faith that it has a direct relationship to the person's ability to perform the duties of a particular job is entitled to decline to hire that person for that job. proposed code language in 23.10.030, use of criminal history in employment decisions, sets out exactly what would constitute a violation of the ordinance. In Section B, the second part, for example, talks about an employer violates this chapter if an employer accesses or inquires into a person's criminal history prior to making a conditional offer of employment. That would be one way the ordinance would be violated. Again, it states in the ordinance, the employer may rescind a conditional offer of employment or take another adverse employment action based upon a person's criminal history if an employer determines in good faith that the specific offense or conduct has a direct relationship to a person's ability to perform the duties or responsibilities of the employment. The ordinance would create an administrative procedure within the city to do three things. One, review, investigate, and determine if an employer accessed or inquired into a person's criminal history prior to making a conditional offer of employment. The second thing it would do is examine whether the employer made an individualized assessment of a person's criminal history using the EEOC nature time nature test. And the third would be to assure that the required process outlined in 23.10.050 when an employer makes an adverse employment decision is followed. So the characteristics of this violation scheme don't lend themselves to a private right of action where a trier of fact would substitute its own judgment for that of the employer. The proposed ordinance would penalize employers with a monetary fine for failing to engage in the required process. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, over the last few months, I have reviewed ordinances and laws passed by other municipalities and states and have provided you with a summary chart of the highlights of those ordinances, comparing them to the ordinance being proposed for Portland. Lastly, I would like to be clear that this ordinance would not prohibit employers from reviewing a person's criminal history, nor would they be required to hire a person with such a history. The proposed ordinance would merely delay inquiries so an employer and applicant could together flesh out a person's qualifications and experience first to obtain the policy, initiatives outlined in the ordinance. Unless you have other specific questions, I was going to stop there. I just wanted to highlight the differences and be around for questions.
Okay. I know Commissioner Salzman did.
So. Yeah, I have some questions that I want to just review, and I think I reviewed them all yesterday with you, but I want to get them on the record. So so please explain what the hearings officer would be considering when determining whether or not an employer has violated this ordinance. Now, as I understand from our conversation yesterday, if an employer does the individualized assessment following the EEOC time, nature, time, nature, is that right?
Yes.
Nature, time, nature, guidelines, in good faith, that is sufficient, but I guess I explain it to me on the record.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's exactly what you've said. So the ordinance is crafted so that the behavior of not going through an individualized assessment is what would be a violation of the ordinance. So as in section 23.10.030, use of criminal history in employment decisions, that section outlines what is required of the employer. A, it just speaks to that it's an unlawful employment practice to do anything contrary to this ordinance. Mm-hmm. B talks about an employer may consider a person's criminal history in the hiring process only after making a conditional offer of employment. So they have to get to that stage. In D, it talks about when making a determination, the nature, time, nature test. And then section 23.10.050 sets out what needs to be done procedurally if you would like to make an adverse employment decision. So outlined in 23.10.030.050,
so if
and onward are the procedure that have to be followed by employers.
So what is meant by, who determines what a good faith effort is? I mean, we spent a lot of time in procurement issues talking about this, and I don't think we really, you know, we've tried to deal with this. But so, yeah, who determines whether a good faith effort was made under this ordinance?
That is what would come before the hearing officer, sort of the evidence of how the process by which an employer made their decision. I'll give an example that, you know, we talked about sort of different examples and what could come up in our conversations. If, for example, advocates sent a group of potential employees to one business and they got sort of the same result over and over, the fact that those folks were treated similarly, were they people with criminal histories, would sort of lend us to think that maybe the procedure was not followed. So at a hearing, the hearing officer could request information about what did you do? Did you, you know, when did you review the criminal histories of these people? When did you inquire into the criminal histories of these people? Those are the kinds of things that the hearing officer could determine and be the fact finder on, not second guessing the actual decision being made by the employer.
So if the employer or prospective employer produced the nature time nature test and said, here is the test I went through with this particular employee, is that something, you know, that's different than a that's different than an apparent pattern of discrimination against people with records, I guess.
Certainly, I just used the pattern example because I think it would be an easier way to make a determination. I just set that out as an example of a way that we could it would come to our attention, to the city's attention, that a violation occurred. It would be easier than one individual person coming back and saying, "I think my individual rights were violated."
If an employer shows he or she did the nature test, and that goes to a hearings officer, that would be at the request of the city for the hearings officer to review that claim?
Well, so the procedure outlined is that the city would receive complaints, mm-hmm. be they by individuals, be they from advocacy groups, alleging violations of the ordinance. The city would do an investigation. They would review the information that came to them. The process is not yet fully fleshed out, but whatever process were to be established by the city attorney and in the admin rules, that process would be followed. If the city would then try to mediate with the employer. A letter would be sent. Some conciliation efforts would take place to see if something could be worked out with the employer. If those efforts failed, then yes, the city, some arm of the city, would bring a case before the hearing officer. And that case would be to determine whether or not a good faith assessment was made.
Okay. And if the if the hearings officer does make a decision that a good faith effort of the nature time nature test was made,
then that would end the inquiry.
That ends it. So the city, the job applicant has no further course of appeal.
Under the scheme, as it's written, yes.
Under that circumstance. Okay. And then, so whether or not an employer has violated the ordinance, it would be subject to appeal only by the, well, it wouldn't be, as long as there's a good faith nature time nature test, it wouldn't be subject to further appeal.
Theoretically, it could be, but my understanding is it's generally not what happens. Although on the side of the employer, were the employer to be found in violation, the employer would have an appeal.
Right.
I think we're anticipating that our normal, Tracy Reeves, Portland City Attorney, I think we're anticipating that our normal code hearings officer procedures would be followed. The appeal from a code hearings office decision is generally a writ of review to circuit court. It would be highly, highly unusual for the city to be appealing a code hearings officer decision to circuit court. It has happened. Mm-hmm. However, an employer who was found to have violated the ordinance at the code hearings level would have a right to seek a writ of review in circuit court.
Okay. And then, so I want to ask the question I asked yesterday, and I think a lot of people have asked you the same sort of scenario playing, and I know it makes some people uncomfortable to talk about it, but I know a lot of women who I work with, it doesn't make them uncomfortable at all. In fact, it concerns them. The idea that if somebody who is a registered sex offender, convicted sex offender, convicted rapist, could be denied a job if that job involves being around children, being around older adults, being around women at closing time of a restaurant, for instance. So talk to me about that.
Commissioner, there are exceptions written into 23.10.040. And those exceptions, we talked about the first, but the second exception speaks to just what you're talking about. They would not apply, this ordinance would not apply where a federal, state, or local law or regulation requires or authorizes the consideration of a person's criminal history. And these situations would include but not be limited to employment with law enforcement or the criminal justice system, private security employment where a license is required by the Oregon Department of Safety Standards and Training, employment involving direct access to or the provision of services to children, the elderly, persons with disabilities, persons with mental illness, or individuals with alcohol or drug dependence or substance abuse disorders. Absolutely. Also, employment requires licensing, being registered, certified, or otherwise authorized to practice your profession. Speaking to the second question, the nature test is always going to come into play. So once an employer after the conditional offer stage, if they decide to look at someone's criminal history and one of these convictions is on that criminal history, they can engage in the nature test and the nature of the crime, the time that has elapsed since the crime took place, and the nature of the job sought. And again, if the employer makes a good faith assessment that the criminal conviction is related to one of those three factors, they can deny a person employment or rescind a conditional offer of employment.
So if I'm the regional manager of a McDonald's and I'm looking for a manager of one of the local restaurants, and I make a conditional offer to somebody, find out they're registered sex offender, convicted rapist, whatever, and I conclude, my employees are 90% female. I'm not comfortable having this guy supervising them, particularly on late night shifts and where they're going to be closing.
Putting myself in the place of a hearings officer, I think what you're talking about is making an assessment of the nature of the crime and the nature of the employment sought. So you are in essence doing that math in your head while we're having this conversation. The nature of the crime being a sex crime and the nature of the position being sought is with access to maybe young women or young people at vulnerable times of day. So you're talking about the very test
that is the
that
test.
Is required.
So that in the example I just ran through, that could be a legitimate exercise of that test.
Without putting myself in the place of the hearings officer. Yes, sir.
Okay, and then I had just two other questions. One is the estimated expenses of 3/4 of an FTE and then $500,000 in money for education. Where do those numbers come from? Is there a budget that's been prepared?
I'm going to let the city attorney speak to that.
Commissioner Saltzman, we believe it would take us about 3/4 of an FTE the first year of implementation of this ordinance to work with the training, get training developed, develop administrative rules, do training. In terms of the actual outreach budget, that's something that the mayor's office has developed the projections for the training budget. But we believe that we could do the work necessary to support the first year of implementation of this for 3/4 of an FTE.
And that's really a placeholder. Yeah, the outreach money is really just a placeholder. We have to honestly say there's going to be some cost if we're going to do this right in terms of employer education. But that's a placeholder number until we get into more detailed understanding of what we're going to be doing and when.
Okay. And then I guess my last question for, again, Tracy Reeve is, we had this discussion yesterday about enforcement responsibilities kind of being all over the place within the city and your desire to want to bring some more uniformity and consistency and perhaps a central office for enforcing various laws. Is that something you're prepared to take a lead on in that effort?
One of my objectives for the next year is to serve at least as a facilitator and coordinator of that discussion within the city. There are a variety of bureaus that would need to be at the table. I don't even know that the outcome of those discussions would be a particular office. I do know that as a city and compared to comparable cities of our size, we really lack civil rights and other sort of rights enforcement capacity. We also are deficient, I would say, or at least not where we would like to be in our capacity to do independent investigations in a variety of fronts. And so that's something that in my work plan for the coming year, I'm hoping to take on, at least a facilitating or coordinating function with a variety of bureaus. Certainly it's something I've had preliminary discussions with the director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, the director of the Bureau of Human Resources, the city auditor and ombudsman, and I'm sure many others in the city would be involved in those discussions. But as council continues to look at a variety of ways to protect residents of the city of Portland, whether it be sick leave, whether it be regulations to protect disability rights, whether it be ban the box, we have not historically had good enforcement or investigation capacity, and that's something that I think we as a city need to have a discussion around and look at and bring some proposals forward for your consideration.
Well, that is on your to-do list for this.
It absolutely is.
And then my final question was, first of all, Mayor, I do want to commend you for, bringing this issue forward. I think it's a very important issue. I think Commissioner Fritz and I both last time suggested a work group to look at this before we passed it. But we're here today. I think, we're going to pass it, I guess, next week, maybe. But are you still interested in convening some sort of business work group?
I am for helping us with the administrative rules.
Yes, administrative rules. Yeah. Okay. So bet. We'll do that then.
Why aren't we having that to inform the ordinance?
Because it's a fairly straightforward policy call. Where are we going to do this? And the bare outlines of how we are going to do it put into code, and then with much more detail into administrative rule. And I think that's the approach that made sense to me in taking this on in the first place.
What we found in sick leave is that we had an ordinance that we thought was the best approach when we convened the task force with balanced representation. We found that, in fact, there were some improvements that could be made in the ordinance. And so I encourage you to think about doing that, Mayor, because it was only, as you remember, three meetings between the first and second reading. It was only a month between the readings.
Right.
And it seemed like that. Going back to then amend ordinances once you find the glitch. And actually, I have a few questions as well.
Okay.
But I'd like you to consider doing that, because I've already heard emails from business owners raising what I think are some pretty legitimate points.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hear what else you have. Dan, others? Other points you had?
Well, I wanted to follow up on the question that Commissioner Saltzman was asking about regarding the exemptions. Only mine was kind of the other way around. In 2310.040, it says that these are the exceptions. It says, B, the prohibitions in this chapter do not apply where a federal, state, or local law or regulation requires or authorizes the consideration of a person's criminal history. And it says, including but not limited to, and then in number three, it goes employments in that you quoted, including direct access to the provision of services to children. I'm wondering, are there federal, state, or local laws that describe the situation Commissioner Saltzman described with a late-night supervisor serving potentially minors, supervising minors? Is there a state law that says that we can do that?
I can't speak to the full panoply of state law and whether or not there's one specifically that would ban the situation that the commissioner spoke to. What I can speak to and what this is guided by are the state of Oregon, not familiar with all the agencies yet, Department of Human Services, when they are giving funds for the care of the elderly, daycare centers and the like, they have a matrix, as I call it, which is a list of prohibited convictions that people can't have in order to be hired into those jobs. So my thought was that kind of a matrix could inform other like positions. If you have a private rehab facility or a private daycare center, excuse me, your decisions could be informed by the state matrix.
I'm concerned that the state matrix may not give us broad enough authority, but if you look at B3 without the preamble at the beginning of B, employments involving the direct access or the provision of services to children, that's definitely retail jobs, service jobs. You know, if anywhere those kids are around, could an employer invoke this in order to be able to do background checks earlier?
I'm going to hesitate to want to have a catch-all that sort of makes it so that any employment could fall into this category. The state's matrix is based on the care of. We're talking about nursing homes, rehab centers, daycare centers, where the job is to care for a vulnerable person versus an establishment where a child might come, which will be almost any establishment, be it a Starbucks, be it a grocery store, or just really any establishment. But that child would presumably be in the care of an adult, and the job would not be to care for that vulnerable child. So that's the nuance. I hope that answers your question.
That's how I would read that.
Yeah, I have concerns about that language, and I would like it considered more. I also, in the next section, section 10050, it says that this is for making the adverse employment decision. The notice may be hand-delivered, emailed, or mailed by U.S. mail. And then A2 says, describe the person's right to reconsideration within 2 business days after the employer provides the notice. So that, to me, sounds like the 2 business days start when the employer mails the notice, and sometimes a letter doesn't arrive for 2 days in my part of the town.
Under the civil code, there's an additional 3 days for mailing. That would be spoken to in the administrative rules. But when you mail anything for legal purposes, you would get an additional 3 days. So the 2 days would only kick in if the person was either hand-delivered the notice, then they would have 2 days. But if it was put in the mail, there'd be an additional 3 days on either side of the mailing.
And where's the burden of proof? How do you prove that you hand-delivered or that the person did or did not receive it?
In the legal profession, we file what's called an affidavit of service. But also in the administrative rules, we can address those kinds of things so that employers could have, just as we plan to do some kind of a safe harbor notice provision, in that safe harbor notice provision, there could be something about, you know, so-and-so certifies that they placed this in the mail, or so-and-so certified that they made a phone call and actually spoke to X person. So I think we can work those details out in the administrative rules in terms of the adding mailing days or something in the safe harbor notice provision that could be a checkoff box or a category that says, this is how I affected service or notice, excuse me, to the candidate.
So again, I'd like to have some more discussion between employers or hiring managers and employees as to whether that 2 days is the right length of time to allow that. And then I'm really concerned about this $500,000. I'm trying to get information. We didn't have anything like $500,000 for educating on sick time. So that seems like an enormous number.
It's a plug number. Don't worry.
Well, I would
get
think
to talk 50, about it.
It's much more like 50,000 rather than 500,000.
We'll get to budgeting when we get to budgeting. But the question is, are we going to spend money? Yes.
Well, again, I was admonished in my parks acquisition today that I would be requesting that rather than stating in the FIPIS that it's needed. And
we need to disclose potential financial impact up front. We're supposed to do that, right?
Right. So what was, and I've had some discussion with Ms. Pepler about this, what was the pros and cons of doing it in-house versus doing it with Bowley?
Well, Judy can talk about that some more, as probably Tracy can as well, but it doesn't appear from our initial review that it's necessarily going to save us that much money to have Bowley do it. And, of course, we also have more administrative control over how things are processed and how quickly if we're doing them ourselves.
Yeah, Commissioner Fritz, I'm not at all convinced that it would be less expensive to have Boley do it. As you know from our experience with sick leave, while Boley is doing the actual enforcement work, city staff still spend a tremendous amount of time getting the administrative rules up, preparing the training materials, working with Boley to make all that happen, and participating with Boley in the trainings. So it's not as if we elect the Boley route, staff is not doing some heavy lifting. On something like this that is not a wage and hour regulation, doesn't have, I would not anticipate, and I could be wrong, but I would not anticipate the same level of enforcement activity right off the bat with this and the same number of things going to hearing that you would have, say, with sick leave that's involving, are you being paid appropriately? That tends to be a pretty contested area of the law. And taking out that interface with a third agency and or a second agency and being able to hone the city's own policies and then develop the city's own enforcement mechanisms, I think, does have economies of scale and also enables us to, in some ways, control our own destiny and design the type of enforcement mechanism that we want to have. So because it's a process statute, because you're really looking at, is the employer complying with the process requirements? I don't see it being nearly as complex of an enforcement endeavor as sick leave was.
So let me, I don't know if you run that course, but let me, particularly going back to Dan's questions, I think it's very good that you're asking these detailed scenario questions of what if, how, because it's really important that we test the structure of the ordinance against those kind of scenarios. But I guess something that would be helpful to me is looking at your summary. A number of these other municipalities have had these kinds of regulations in place for some time. Do we have some information yet, as yet, about how frequent enforcement has even been necessary? My sense is that when cities, we included, have taken on a civil rights issue, that we set the bar and most people comply without enforcement. When we say you can't discriminate based on sexual orientation, for example, which Portland did before the state did, I don't recall having a lot of enforcement activity, but I do recall a lot of quick acceptance and compliance. I'm hoping that that's going to be very much the case here, because we are even hearing from folks that aren't completely happy about us taking this on that, of course, we agree with the goal here. So it's one of those cases, I believe, where if we have that kind of congruity in the community, that most people support the goal, even if they have some arguments about the particulars, I think we won't be doing a lot of enforcement, and that prediction could be perhaps informed by what's happened in Philadelphia or Seattle. So I don't know if we've got that kind of track record information from the other cities yet, but are they in court every day, or is it rare?
My understanding is it's rare. I'll give you the Philadelphia example because it's very specific what their statute. First of all, these other jurisdictions are able to place a ban on the actual box, which maybe we'll discuss later why that may not be such a good idea in Portland. So turning in an application that has a box on it is violative of those ordinances. So a lot of times what has happened is folks have turned those in, and those cities have done conciliation with the employers, and for the most part, as you say, they have complied. I know that Philadelphia had some issue with national employers who said, you know, we don't want to have to change our application for every state or jurisdiction that we have stores in or whatever, and those are the contentious cases. And when I last spoke to them, I think there were two of those cases. The other jurisdictions, except for Rochester, have an administrative enforcement mechanism within their cities, so they are able to do more conciliation, more. There has not been a heated docket of ban the box litigation or enforcement. The NELP, the National Employment Law Project, I had this handout sent passed around to you, is sort of chock full of really good anecdotes. I didn't want to, like, walk through them, but there are They're specifically Durham, North Carolina, which I think I spoke to last time, which kept track. The city and county of Durham banned the box internally, and they tracked from the time that they did so how many folks they hired with criminal histories and whether or not they had any negative experiences. And there were no negative experiences, but their rates of hiring people with criminal histories shot up. So this is very well put together by the National Employment Law Project with a lot of those kinds of anecdotal examples.
Have you considered an exemption for companies that already aimed to hire people returning from incarceration, like Dave's Killer Bread? We got an email from Portland Bottling saying that 47% of their team members are currently second-chance citizens.
There is an exception, Commissioner, 23.10.040C talks about prohibitions of this chapter do not apply to any position designated by the employer as part of a federal, state, or local government program designed to encourage the employment of those with criminal histories.
But I don't think those companies do it as part of the federal program? Is that because they get the tax break from the feds?
I think it's through workforce programs, but it's a fair question. We ought to check on that.
I'll let the advocates speak to this, but I know in our meetings with some of advocates who work with folks with criminal histories that some of those models are not considered the ideal models for people coming out of incarceration with criminal histories, is to sort of send them to locations where many of the people who work in a certain location are people with criminal histories, that the idea is to really get folks to go mainstream and not continue to associate with people who are only ex-offenders. So I'll really let the advocates speak more to that, because that's more of a policy consideration.
Commissioner Novick, do you have any other questions out of the gate here?
I share Commissioner Fritz's concern about the language of 2310.040B3, because I think just looking at it as written, it strikes me it's possible that it could turn out to be an exception you could drive a truck through. On enforcement, although it may be that the experience of other cities suggests that I'm being paranoid, I start from a different place than the mayor. My assumption is that laws are useless without enforcement. That's partially based on being told when I worked for the Justice Department doing environmental law that the Soviet Union had great environmental laws and a terrible environment because they didn't enforce them. And the penalty for violating the Clean Air or the Clean Water Act at least used to be up to $25,000 per day per violation. And those laws generally were, complied with. $1,000 per violation doesn't sound like very much. And I'm curious, I actually don't know, what are the penalties for violating the federal employment discrimination statutes?
Well, the penalties for the federal employment discrimination statutes can be many things other than a penalty. You can get back pay. You can get reinstated, all kinds of. But again, those discrimination laws have a scheme of a fact finder second guessing, for lack of a better term, what the employer has done and saying, no, your assessment was wrong. We say, yes, it was race discrimination. This ordinance does not have that kind of scheme. This ordinance is a procedural ordinance asking employers to consider certain things under the EEOC 2012 guideline, the nature, time, nature test, making a good faith determination that the job is related to the conviction. And the penalties will come as a result of not following the procedure. There won't be these additional penalties or injunctive relief given to a candidate who did not get a job. So the scheme is very different. So comparing them is a little bit difficult.
Based on what you just said, it sounds like, with the employment discrimination statutes, there are other remedies here that an employer would have to pay attention to. Here, if all you've got is up to a $1,000 penalty for an employer to worry about, doesn't that sound like, what does McDonald's care if three times they have $1,000 assessed against them?
Well, if McDonald's, which is presumably doing a high volume of applicant consideration and hiring, is found to be routinely not complying, that's going to be many thousands of dollars, because every time they don't engage in this process for every applicant, that's an additional violation. So those could pile up pretty quickly for a large employer that's just choosing not to comply. I certainly don't mean to suggest, when we talk about doing an internal enforcement and when we talk about having a goal of conciliation and securing compliance, that that doesn't mean that you need the other foot to drop sometimes if those efforts aren't successful. And one of the things that we would envision is having the capacity to do some investigation and find those would be the employers, I think, that we would be hoping that advocates would be identifying for us and that we would then be looking into and identifying ourselves if we're getting complaints from job applicants. And where you see those repeat violations, I think those do start to add up. Obviously, if over time we're not finding that we have the deterrent effect in securing compliance, we can look at that, and that may need to be ratcheted up.
Okay. Other initial questions? Because I want to get to testimony. Thank you both very much. So we want to take testimony from those who signed up last time and didn't get the chance and were courteous and were able to wait until now and waited even longer. So let's take those folks. I think we also have someone from the Restaurant Association who needs to leave fairly shortly. So let's maybe take the first three and then see where we are.
Okay. I didn't see anybody on the current list who signed up from the previous list. So I will go ahead and go with the current list. Except for Charles Johnson, he did sign up previously, and Marion Haynes and Steve McCoy.
Yeah, okay, Mr. McCoy is from the Restaurant Association. Come on up, all three, please. Johnson, I think you get to be first this time instead of last.
Good morning, Commissioners. I hope that you'll be able to move this forward quickly, and I hope that we will have a little bit more conversation on the ability to literally ban the box. In addition to these procedural, you know, there's about 10 pages of PDF that get into all these little 23.this.that. But most often, and with the t-shirt I'm wearing today, I'm here to you about the homeless issue. And I think one problem we've had here is not connecting the dots. If we want to not have 3,000 people sleeping on the streets of Portland, which is seems to be the position of the Portland Business Alliance, and they generally support this ordinance, then we need to have real conversations about the labor market and moving more people into sustainable jobs. Otherwise, they're going to be on the dole. So with, I want you to continue to work hard to get this ordinance in effect as quickly as possible, and to look at how that particularly affects the houselessness problem in the city. How many of these people that are causing an increase in police man hours and work for Clean and Safe are people who feel blocked out from the job market? And especially considering how good the city budget is looking and the fact that we might put $500,000 into this program, I think that some of that money might also be tied in to outreach, to reaching some of these people and letting them know that they have a better chance of employment, that they don't have to feel like as soon as they go and they admit that they had a criminal offense in whatever scope of time, that they're just wasting their time looking for work, so they'll just continue to sleep in a doorway on 1st or 2nd or 3rd Avenue. As to the conversation about particular offenses and risks, you know, obviously business owners need to be concerned about liability. But when we talk about, and I think incongruously lumped together actual rapists with all other sex offenders, we really need to go back and talk about the women's strength and girl power programs. People can't rely on legislation and the background check of an employer to protect themselves. So women and parents should just know that any time that they're concerned about somebody, they should just go to www.nsopw.gov and check the person out for themselves, not rely on what some manager who's hectic or had a personal preference for a worker did. I don't think that that's really going to be an area of litigation. Obviously, you know, employers, just on the general issue of liability, are going to have a legal standing to keep their employees safe. So I don't think we need to finesse that language so much. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, commissioners, Marion Haynes with the Portland Business Alliance. I won't repeat the fact that, you know, you all know that we support the goal of removing barriers to employment and do support banning the box on applications. We had been concerned that there was not a more inclusive dialogue in developing the ordinance language. That was before we had actually seen ordinance language, which we've now had an opportunity to do, and listening to the discussion and questions with the previous presenters. And I think we are growing more and more concerned, frankly, with what we see before us. And we would like the opportunity to address some of the issues and make the ordinance work in a way that will work for both applicants and employers. In my review, I have also looked at other jurisdictions. I have Seattle's ordinance right here. I have Philadelphia's ordinance right here. They look absolutely nothing like what is before you today. They're very, very different. Much less cumbersome, much less burdensome, much less process back and forth. None of the notice issues, things like that. There are things in the ordinance before you right now that cannot be addressed in administrative rule. There's inconsistencies in the document that need to be addressed before it goes to the rulemaking point. We have a number of questions and concerns that I think by all means we can and should have a dialogue to work through, but I think that this, the way that this ordinance is structured, it is dangerously close to creating a new protected class. The EEOC guidance, which is a good guidance and tool for employers, just generally to use, but really specifically applies to when criminal histories do have a disparate impact on protected classes based on race or national origin, things of that nature. Very concerned about the language that says that you have to have a direct relationship to the person's ability to perform the duties and responsibilities of a job. Again, that goes beyond the language that EEOC uses in looking at discrimination based on federally identified protected classes. The language that they use is job-related and consistent with business necessity. So once again, we've gone far beyond, and looking at the experience in other jurisdictions is not particularly useful in looking at what this might do here. The nature, time, nature test, you know, we're pretty familiar with. I think the third bullet in that, the second nature, has some additional considerations that generally are built out around that that we could use to have included in this ordinance. We have some questions about what it means to access a criminal history. What if that access is inadvertent? How would you deal with something like that? It also says that you can't make the inquiry. I understand that we can't ban the box because of free speech issues. And so how can we then ban the actual verbal inquiry? I think that's something that needs more discussion and something to be worked out. We have a lot of concerns about the safety issues that Commissioner Saltzman and Fritz raised. The way that I read this language, those 1, 2, 3, 4 factors that are in the exemptions are preconditioned on there being a state, federal, or local law that speaks to those specific issues. And I'm not sure that that's what the city intended. I don't think that that's broad enough for some circumstances where people will have potential access to or proximity to populations that we ought to be really quite concerned about. The sort of back and forth after a determination has been made is unusual in my review of some of these other ordinances. The 2 days with the extra 3 days for the notice, and yet there's language that says 4 days after the adverse decision is made, that decision is final. You can't reconcile that. We can't do that in administrative rules. There's an inconsistency in the code right now. There's also some inconsistencies in the record keeping, the statute of limitations, which actually doesn't exist, and the limitation of action. So the city can take action within 6 months of learning about something, But that doesn't mean that that's within 6 months of when the action actually occurred, and yet there's a one-year record keeping. So we have another built-in inconsistency in the ordinance that I'm not sure can be resolved through administrative rules. We really don't understand the provision that allows the city to conduct a conciliation effort to remediate the violations. There was some discussion about what is the violation. Is that you didn't follow the process, or is it there will be a second guessing of the employer's good faith judgment? The only place when I can see any language with any clarity that that is not going to be the case is in the findings of the ordinance, not actually in the whereases, which are operative and nowhere in the code language. That's a concern. So all in all, you know, we would like to get to a place where we can support this. We very much support the goal. We support banning the box. You know, we would like to see criminal background histories allowed during the interview process. That's what by far most jurisdictions allow that have done this. It's ironic, I think, a little bit to us that when we were first approached, the idea was that removing the box will allow people to have a conversation about the totality of the person, their criminal background, whether that was relevant to a particular job or not, because it's quite possible that that box was impeding those conversations. Unfortunately, we've swung the pendulum so far with this particular ordinance that we're prohibiting those conversations once again. And I think that, that concerns us. So in the spirit of conversation and dialogue, we would ask that we take a little bit more time, get all the affected parties to the table, and work through some of these issues. Thank you.
Thanks. Let me get you to clarify a couple things, because in the extensive discussions that you've had with my staff about this proposal, you've said some things here that sound a little inconsistent with that. So you said at the outset that you support banning the box, but you said later in your testimony that you understand that we cannot do that. Does the Portland Business Alliance believe that it's legally possible in Oregon with our free speech clause in our Constitution to have an ordinance like these other cities where we require employers to ban the box? Do you believe that that's legally permissible in Oregon?
We have not commissioned a legal opinion to determine that yet.
But we don't believe that it is. So that's why the ordinance is written this way. If someone wants to bring us a legal opinion that says that it is possible to actually require employers to ban the box, I'll be interested in hearing that. But it's our understanding and our city attorney's understanding that it is not legally permissible for a municipality in Oregon to say you may not put the box on your application because of our free speech clause. And so that's why the ordinance is written differently than the other city's ordinances.
As still, the other city's ordinances do allow criminal background checks during the interview process. They don't have some of the elements that this one does. We have not commissioned a legal review of that. I would note that, as you're probably aware, there are two bills in the legislature right now that also address this issue, and legislative council has seen fit to include banning the box in those in the state of Oregon. So, again, that's not a formal legal opinion. It's not a court opinion, but there does seem to be some potential disagreement out there about whether that's permissible or not.
Okay. Well, that's informative. Thank you. Other questions?
So when you say that Portland Business Alliance is in favor of banning the box, you're saying you're in favor of supporting people being able to have an opportunity for interviewing and for getting jobs. Is that
absolutely
the shorthand for that?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Which I just would have to note is really different from sick time, where the PBA was pretty clear they didn't like it at all. They're willing to come to the table to help make it better, which you did. So I do think there's an opportunity with us, I think, many people being on the same page as wanting to give people a second chance.
Very much.
That we should be able to come up with something that we all think will work well.
That's what we would hope. Thank you.
Okay, good. Dan, did you have a question?
Well, you mentioned in testimony, I think, that there were things in the ordinance that you wanted to see in the rules. Did you want to be specific?
The one thing that I had not seen in the code language that was referenced by the last speakers is clarity that a employer's good faith judgment that the criminal history is related to the job is not clear in the code, that judgment won't be second-guessed. There is in number 8, I think it was, of the findings of the ordinance language that got to that issue, but that's not really the operative language of the ordinance, and it's not what's getting put into code. And I think that is a very important detail, one of those ones that, You know, this is something because employers are exposed to liability. There are real safety issues at risk and real opportunities for a lot of people. And so our goal is really to make it right so that it works for both employers and applicants, and we have the best opportunity to really reach the goal that we all share.
So if we took that finding and put it in the code, you're saying it's a stronger, more clear rationale, at least of what I understand the good faith efforts to be all about.
It appears that that would help.
Okay.
Not one issue, yeah.
Okay, you're on, Mr. McCoy. Sorry, go ahead.
A couple of questions from Marion. First of all, I share Commissioner Fritz's appreciation that PBA's attitude is if we could ban the box, then you're all in favor of literally banning the box. Question I had is, in terms of the timing of when a background check or something like a background check can be done, my sort of off-the-cuff assumption was that employer probably wouldn't go to the trouble and expense of doing a background check until they'd gotten to the conditional offer stage anyway. Have you found that there's a number of employers who actually have a procedure where after they've interviewed five people, they do background checks on all of them?
Commissioner Novick, it really varies by business. People aren't going to run around doing a bunch of background checks. I mean, they cost money. You're going to get to a very, very small candidate pool. But I think there are, I have talked to some companies who do wait to the conditional offer stage. I have talked to some who particularly have to do a lot of hiring very fast, maybe for, you know, seasonal things or something like that, that if you get to a very short list, you might start running those background checks because you want to get somebody in, like, within the next couple days to start filling shifts. So it's very much dependent, and I think, you know, what we tried to express when I was here last time is I don't know every single different employer's workplace, job requirements, hiring practices, and there ought to be some level of flexibility for employers who those conditions vary widely.
I could tell you that I've been involved or aware of some city hiring processes where there were three finalists, we've done background checks on all three of them.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McCoy, you're on.
Thank you, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Steve McCoy, President of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. We're here, and it's going to echo a little bit what you just heard from Marianne. We understand the logic of banning the box, and with the caveat, we have no problem with that. We can see where, real frankly, that could be a barrier you can't get by if somebody looks at that and, you know, the resume or the application just goes in the no pile. We understand that logic, but where we have a problem is saying that that business can't question the applicant during the normal flow of an interview when you're going through resumes, when you're going through job history. That seems to be in certain job areas a question you want to ask and not have to go all the way through the process, do a conditional offer, and then ask the question, do we have a criminal history that doesn't work? And let me give you a couple examples. On the lodging side, because I got calls from some of our lodging members, when you've got people working in the rooms and they've got a pass key to every room in the hotel and they've got access to those rooms when the customer is gone with their personal belongings there, they don't want to have people that have history of theft, burglary, those kinds of things in the room. If it's so in the interview process, if that's the job you're getting interviewed for, that's when that question would be asked. If you're going to be working in catering or if you're going to be working as a doorman, that question's not going to be asked, and the demand won't be there. Same with restaurants, handling credit cards, those kinds of issues. What really makes it important in the hospitality industry, which is what I represent, is the incidence of social media, the TripAdvisor and Yelp. All you need is one person to have that bad experience. They've lost something, watch got stolen out of the room, whatever it might be. They're a victim of credit card fraud because somebody got a hold of their credit card number. That goes on Yelp, and now it's not an issue between you and that customer. It's an issue between you, and it can be tens of thousands of potential customers who go to those sites to see what's going on when they're making a decision whether to frequent the business or not. So what we think, it's one-size-all approach, which is what we're seeing here in the proposal, it doesn't fit in every instance. And what we would like is a little more flexibility is needed in the ordinance. And again, if it's expanding the box, that's fine. And what really bothers us and what we think is needed and to is, again, input from business. We're more than happy to come to the table, sit down with the proponents, discuss this, hash it out, find out where the barriers and the blockages are, and work out something that works better for everybody.